Hello, it's Wednesday, May the 5th. I'm Andrew Pearce, and this is The Andrew Pearce Show, and it's coming as ever from the Daily Mail newsroom. We're going to be talking about Manchester City. They finally made it to the final of the European Champions League. Also, should we be trying out the Japanese art of mindful spending? No, I don't know either. We're talking to Dr. Ellie Cannon about the idea that everyone over 50 or in a vulnerable group are going to be offered a third jab this autumn. That's me. We're also talking about the poll which suggests that Scotland's SNP will not get an overall majority, which makes the prospect of a referendum on independence much less likely. But first, the collapse of the case against two former paratroopers for the alleged killing of an official IRA commander, Joe McCann, has led to calls for all prosecutions from the Troubles to be dropped. Some Tory MPs are calling it the witch hunt of soldiers who served in Northern Ireland, who are facing historic prosecutions for their involvement in the Troubles in the 1970s. The first case involving two paratroopers, both in their 70s, walked free from court on Tuesday, 49 years after a senior IRA commander allegedly responsible for the deaths of 15 British soldiers was shot and killed as he tried to evade capture. The judge ruled their statements were inadmissible. Joining me now is Tobias Elwood, who is a former defence minister, and he is chairman, of course, of the House of Commons Defence Select Committee. Mr. Elwood, there are about 200 other former servicemen in the dark, anxious, not knowing whether they too are going to face these sorts of prosecutions. Is it the job now of the government, somebody in the government, just to say enough now or not?
Absolutely right. And I think the case that you summarised there poses very difficult, awkward questions as to why two veterans in their 70s were put into court almost 50 years after the event took place, when there was no case made back in 1972. It didn't go to court then. And when this case was then subject to review in 2010, following this historical inquiries team investigation. And as you say, there are other inquiries pending too. And I do hope that the government will pay heed to this and recognize that it is simply wrong to put veterans through this horror, this mental stress, when no new evidence has occurred.
What do you say to those people in Northern Ireland who say somebody in their family or a friend was killed, perhaps potentially by a soldier who potentially is facing a court case? They will argue, how do they get their justice served?
And that is the big question that the Good Friday Agreement tried to look at. How do you go through a truth and reconciliation process very similar to what we saw in places like Rwanda or indeed South Africa? How can every family then draw a conclusion during these horrible times? Now, the Good Friday Agreement pointed to a number of unresolved cases in their hundreds, actually in their thousands or so, but whittled down to about hundreds that was agreed, which could be reopened. But what we're seeing, what might have seemed a good idea at the time, is now causing a lot of heartache and pain on both sides of this equation. Absolutely right that our armed forces must follow international law. Our reputation as to who we are when we bear arms in the first place to defend the rule of law is so important. We've got to follow the Geneva Conventions and so forth and hold any soldiers to account. But if no new evidence comes forward, as clearly was the case in this case, we have to ask ourselves why, almost 50 years after the event, that we are actually forcing people to go through the courts. That's simply wrong. And I do hope the government will learn from this and draw a line on this and allow us to then finally move forward.
And if I could ask you on that, we know that when Tony Blair was Prime Minister, it came out sometime later, he wrote what were called, I think, comfort letters to a number of convicted IRA terrorists who have been on the run, and he effectively gave them an amnesty from prosecution. People might argue it's been too skewed in one way in favour of the terrorists rather than soldiers who were, after all, doing their job for Queen and country.
Yes, and you point to the very difficult circumstances in which the Good Friday Agreement came about. I served there myself in the 1990s, and I have to say it was one of the most difficult tours that I've served in my time in the armed forces. And I was so pleased that finally there was an agreement and peace could prevail. So difficult decisions had to be made. We recognize that. But the idea now that we go through with a fine-tooth comb to look back at evidence, call people up front again, and question them on events that happened decades ago when nothing new has been forthcoming, I think is absolutely wrong. So you can understand the reaction today when there are other veterans, many of them in my regiment, the Royal Green Jackets, you know, who had their doors knocked on in the last number of years, recent years, to say, can you remember what happened back in those days? Of course they can't. They don't have a reflection. But then they weren't arrested back then. They weren't arrested in 2010 when this was given scrutiny as well. So I hope that this case, in all the publicity that it's gained, the fact that we're talking about it today, will make people recognize that this approach that Tony Blair came up with is not able to conclude the events which took place back in the 1970s.
And just finally, do you think the is it a decision for the Prime Minister, or is it a decision for the Justice Secretary? Who makes these decisions?
Well, I think ultimately it's going to land on the Prime Minister's desk. It's a very, very good question indeed. I mean, we came out, I think, wrongly by promising back in 2019 during the general election to say that all these legacy claims, we're going to look after the vets, we're going to give them some form of amnesty. Well, that's breaching international law. There was no way of doing that by isolating a part of society and giving them additional protection. Ultimately, that protection would have had to been gone through legislation. That legislation would have gone to the Northern Ireland Assembly. There's no way Sinn Féin, that's part of that assembly, would then vote to support that. So there was no legal instrument to provide that. We do need a truth and reconciliation process, which is agreeable on both sides to finally draw a line. I was there when there was a border with Southern Ireland on the island of Ireland, and the damage of that caused, we do not want to go back to those times. We do need to look forward.
All right, that's Tobias Elwood, a former army officer, former defence minister, and he's chairman of the House of Commons Defence Select Committee. Thanks for joining us. Visit mailplus.co.uk to listen to The Andrew Pearce Show for free and in full, along with all our other podcasts and our video series. Remember to tell your Alexa speaker to play Daily Mail News. Nicola Sturgeon's Scottish National Party could miss out on an overall majority in Thursday's elections, as there's been a surge in support for the union in Scotland, according to a new poll. The poll by Savanta Comrade suggests the First Minister could fall six seats short of control of the Scottish Parliament. I'm joined now by Chris Hopkins, Associate Director at Savanta Comrade. It's not first past the post, is it, this election, Chris? There's a list system. Can you explain how it works?
Yeah, essentially half or a significant proportion of MSPs into Holyrood are elected by first past the post. You know, there are 73 constituencies up there, but then to make it more proportional, ultimately, there is a sort of top-up list system, and the idea of that is to allow the parties that perhaps got a fairly sizable chunk of the vote in the constituency or in constituencies but didn't end up winning a lot of them, allow them to end up with some fair representation a bit more proportionally as sort of how well and how popular they are in Scotland. Now what that means ultimately is that the SNP do end up dominating the constituency, and then they don't end up topping many seats up with the list, whereas that's where Conservative and Labour tend to pick up a lot of their MSPs, and then potentially also the Green Party as well.
And of course, it's an interesting test as well, because this is the first election for the new Labour leader in Scotland, Anis Sawa, who he's had pretty good write-ups, but it seems in your poll, Chris, that they've slipped back Labour in the latest poll.
Yeah, it's a bit of a strange one at the moment, where Anis Sawa seems to be increasingly popular. He's had a rise again in our favourability ratings. I think he's only 3 points behind Nicola Sturgeon, who for a fair chunk of the Scottish electorate is really put on a pedestal. So Sawa seems to be fairly popular. It's Labour that aren't necessarily as popular perhaps as their leader. And then it's the flip side with the Conservatives. Douglas Ross doesn't appear to be that popular, but the Conservatives end up doing better. Now what we tend to think that's down to is that if you are a staunch unionist, then which of these parties is going to defend the union a bit better? Well, probably the Conservatives, and therefore maybe you'll end up giving them your vote. Whereas those that are traditionally Labour, they might have in recent months flirted with the idea of independence, flirted with the idea of voting for the SNP. So that's why maybe Labour don't end up doing well. But Anis Sawa clearly is a lot more charismatic than, say, Douglas Ross is.
And of course, Boris Johnson keeps well away from Scotland because he's not popular up there at all, even though he appears to be doing much better in England and Wales.
Yeah, not at all. It's probably best that he doesn't really venture north of the border. I mean, like I say, the Conservatives do end up doing okay, but they have a very sort of specific demographic of support, whereas Labour's can be a little bit more mixed. Some SNP voters are probably more likely to be ex-Labour than they are ex-Conservative. So yeah, there's a bit more fluidity there. And I think that's really where Nicola Sturgeon would be looking to get votes from. She isn't really fishing in the pool of those staunch Conservative voters, but maybe those that would be willing to vote Labour. And that's why, even in this poll where it must be said that we are a bit of an outlier at the moment, showing SNP on 42%. Others have them sort of way higher in the 40s, and maybe even above 50. But if the SNP are to get a majority, then they need to convince those Labour voters to vote for them. And there are a lot of SNP Conservative marginal seats in Scotland, and it's important for the SNP to defend the ones that they've got. But also, if they wouldn't need much of the Labour vote to switch over for them to win some Conservative constituencies, particularly in the south of Scotland. So it wouldn't take a huge swing necessarily, based on our polling, for the SNP to end up at least closer to a majority than what we've got them.
And of course, she's desperate to get that majority, because if she gets that majority, she says then she will trigger a second referendum. It wouldn't be binding, of course, because only Parliament in Westminster can agree to that. So there's a lot riding on this poll in the next 24 hours, Chris.
Yeah, there definitely is. I think what happens next is going to be the key question. In a way, what actually happens on Thursday is slightly irrelevant, but obviously it will give us a context for the constitutional battle that Scotland and Westminster are undoubtedly and potentially going to go through in the next few years. And yes, like you say, that doesn't necessarily mean the SNP don't get an overall majority. It doesn't necessarily mean that there won't be a pro-independence majority in Holyrood, obviously with the Green Party potentially taking a fair few seats as well. They are pro-independent, so there may well end up being a pro-independence majority in Holyrood. But does that weaken the legitimacy for an independence referendum if it's not solely the SNP that have the majority? Maybe, and I think that's probably the argument that the UK government in Westminster will make if that ends up being the case.
I'm sure they will. And if I could ask you just finally, Chris, I know this is a poll in Scotland, but all eyes will also be on Hartlepool, up in the north of England, where there is a by-election. Now, Hartlepool has only been Conservative once for a couple of years, since 1945. There was a poll the other day, admittedly only 300 people surveyed, and it was taken 10 days ago, long before the wallpaper row was percolating. Is your hunch that the Conservatives can win that by-election? Because that would be seismic for Keir Starmer, the Labour leader.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, my hunch would be yes, they can win it. Will they win it? I think that is maybe remains to be seen. But yeah, I mean, absolutely, they do appear in a lot of the data and just in general trends to be on course to take that seat in a by-election. And obviously, it is very rare for parties in government to win seats off the opposition at by-elections. So yeah, I mean, it would be pretty unprecedented and fairly unexpected, but. All of the data at the moment and the way things are going, it does appear to be that it's going to be quite a struggle, really, for Labour to end up keeping hold of Hartlepool. And similarly, with some of the mayoral races going on as well, the Conservatives end up holding on to the mayoralship in Tees Valley and in the West Midlands, then that really is a good night for the Conservatives and pretty disastrous for Keir Starmer and for Labour.
Very interesting. That's Chris Hopkins, who's Associate Director at Savanta Comrades. Thanks for joining us.
Cheers, Andrew. Thank you.
Actually, Chris says it's pretty rare. It's been only four times that a governing party has won a seat from the other side in a by-election since the Second World War. So that would be a measure of how big a victory it would be if the Tories win Hartlepool. And Labour will only have themselves to blame because they've chosen an ultra-Remain candidate in a constituency that voted nearly 76% to leave the European Union. When will they ever learn? So that was Chris Hopkins, Associate Director at Savanta Comrades. And if you want to find out more about what's happening in Scotland ahead of Thursday's election, Mail Plus's very own Michael Crick interviewed Nicola Sturgeon this week. You can watch the video free at mailplus.co.uk. People over 50 or in a vulnerable group are going to be offered a third jab this autumn to cut the risk of new vaccine-resistant COVID variants. The hopes are that this will ensure Britain never needs another lockdown, and scientists are working flat out on the technical details of whether to use existing vaccines or a specially tailored one. I'm joined now by the Mail on Sunday's resident GP, Dr. Ellie Cannon. Dr. Ellie, that's partly why, I suppose, the government have bought so many vaccines. I think, didn't Matt Hancock, the Health Secretary, tell us there'd be around 60 million available in the autumn for boosters and the like?
Yes, that's right. That is what he has said. I suppose there's a couple of things that really we need to think about. First of all, we still don't know how long immunity lasts. Now, it does look quite good because we haven't actually had a lot of people reinfected who had sort of COVID in March 2020, for example. So one would assume the immunity does last, but it may not. And the other thing is this possibility of variants. And do we actually need to tweak the vaccinations like we do every year to cover strains of flu to make sure we've got the best protection possible?
What's your hunch on that? Because so far, we think, don't we, that the vaccines have been able to deal with the South African variant, the Kent variant, even the Brazil variant. But of course, more could come into the country, especially when flights resume and holidays abroad resume.
Yeah, certainly. My hunch would be that the variants are covered. And certainly that's what the majority of virologists seem to think, as you say, the South African variant, the Kent variant are all covered by our current vaccinations, which is really reassuring. And immunity isn't all or nothing. It's not black and white. There will be lots and lots of aspects of our immune system that are triggered by these vaccinations. So it may recognize lots of different parts of a virus or just one little part of a virus and still be able to work. So I would like to think that at the moment, you know, a new vaccine because of new variants is not necessary, but it's certainly reassuring that they have this safety net in place in the UK.
And I just finally, you'd have heard Neil Ferguson, we all call him Professor Lockdown, don't we? He was one of the architects of the lockdown strategy. He's pretty confident now we won't need another one because he thinks now more and more the vaccines are increasingly more important in the fight against infection than lockdown. Do you agree with that?
It would certainly seem so. The vaccination drive has been incredibly successful here. We have seen a country like Israel open up without social distancing, all schools open, absolutely everything, and rates just plummet. And I'd certainly like to think that's what we will have here. And it would be fabulous if we don't have another lockdown, because I think that has really, in the end, done a huge amount of harm to a huge number of people.
And in fact, figures have just come through from the Office of National Statistics, Dr. Ellie, about a 19 to 20% increase in depression caused by the pandemic.
Yes, and that's not surprising. And you could spend the morning with me in my GP surgery and just see the number of people who have been affected by COVID without ever having actually contracted COVID, but from restrictions, from job loss, from financial loss, from the anxiety and the panic of lockdown. And the sort of constant scaremongering and news regarding COVID. So I think it has been incredibly damaging for a huge number of people in many different ways. And I think that will take a long time to come out, actually, because some of those things will now just start brewing and bubbling with long-term problems in the future.
That's Dr. Ellie Cannon, who is, of course, the Mail on Sunday's resident GP. If you enjoy the Andrew Pearce Show, we hope you do. We'd like you to subscribe to us. We'd like you to leave us a review on Apple Podcasts, Google or Spotify. You can get in touch by tweeting us at MailPlus or me at Tory Boy Pearce. So Deputy Sports Editor Matt Gatwood joins me now with the latest sports news. Even I know, Matt, even I know Manchester City have reached their first Champions League final, and they did it in great style, beating Paris Saint-Germain 2-0, 4-1 on aggregate.
Exactly, exactly.
And weren't they the favourites?
City would have been the favourites, yeah.
Okay.
But PSG, very strong, got to the final last year, packed with talent. I mean, the one thing that they didn't have last night, which was a real problem for them, was the young French striker, Kylian Mbappe, was injured and couldn't play. So that was a massive blow for them.
Oh, the French always make excuses.
Well, he is a superb player. So that was a real hammer blow. But it was a brilliant performance by Man City. And it's their first final. Pep Guardiola's first final for 10 years.
Right.
He's obviously got close in the past, but not got to a final since his Barcelona days. So brilliant for City. They've been building and building and building. You know, obviously they spent a lot of money, et cetera, but, you know, there's such talent at this end of the tournament that to get there for them finally is a brilliant thing. So, and they played superbly. They thoroughly deserved it. So Foden was superb, De Bruyne was superb, but the defence was exceptional. Now, this team's only conceded 4 goals in the whole of the Champions League to get to this stage so far. So that's all the group games and the last 16 and the quarterfinals and the semi. So just 4 goals conceded, and they were brilliant defensively last night, particularly John Stones and Ruben Dias.
Now, if they win the Cup, do they then go into a World Cup final?
Is there like a world champions? Yes, there's a thing where they play other winners of other continents around the globe.
But it's not as prestigious.
It's not as prestigious, no.
So
it's called the FIFA World Club. Championship.
Now, there's a chance they could be playing Chelsea in the final.
There's a big chance they could be playing Chelsea. So Chelsea go into the second semi-final tonight, the second leg. It's 1-1 from the first leg. So massive game, massive opportunity for Chelsea to get to final.
Who are they playing?
Real Madrid. Real Madrid, delicately poised, 1-1 from the first leg, which was in Spain. And it will be, again, an astonishing performance, because Chelsea, when Thomas Tuchel took over halfway through the season, when your friend Frank Lampard was sacked, you wouldn't have thought Chelsea would be, you know, contenders to win the Champions League. And here they are, you know, one step away from it. It's going to be tight. It's going to be difficult tonight. Chelsea are very difficult to break down under Tuchel. So Real Madrid have got their work cut out. Of course, Real Madrid have to score tonight.
Yeah. Your prediction?
I think it's going to be very tight. I think it's going to be 1-1 at full time, which means it will go to extra time. And I think Chelsea will sneak it 2-1 in extra time.
That's the end of them then.
Well, in some ways, you know, I love the thought of an all-English final because, you know, it'd be great. But I must say, there's something I prefer the thought of a European Cup final being, you know, Real Madrid against Man City.
The best of British against the best of Spanish.
Yeah, because we see Chelsea play Man City twice a season, or if not more.
Well, you do.
Yeah, quite regularly. So it would be nice to see them play European opposition.
Okay,
so.
And that's because you're an Arsenal fan, of course. You can't bear the thought of Chelsea winning the Cup, can you?
Nothing to do with that at
all. No, of course not, of course. And finally, I know about this because you told me about this, the Indian cricket has ground to halt. How could they have been playing anyway?
Well, yeah, that's a good point. I mean, they were ploughing on regardless in the IPL until there were a few positive tests within the team bubbles, which meant that they just couldn't, you know, they tried to carry on, but they basically couldn't play once that happened.
Yeah.
And now they've all headed home and they're trying to find an alternative date to carry on. Obviously, they wanted to carry on. Now, if you're a cynic, you would say that they wanted to carry on because of all the money involved.
Yeah.
Because, you know, all the advertising, all the sponsorship, all the TV deals, all that sort of money pouring in. So that would be the cynical view. The other view would be, well, they wanted to carry on to give the people of India reason to stay in, first of all, and not to mix, and also some, you know, some happiness, some joy in watching cricket, of course.
I'll go for the cynical view.
I thought you might. But eventually they basically became no choice.
Yeah.
You know, now there's a lot of people saying, well, why did it carry on so long?
Mm.
For example, the English players during the South Africa series earlier in the year, you remember there was a couple of breaches of the bubble.
Yeah.
The England were quick to call the tour off and head home. The England players were less quick to call this off or to head home during this. Now, the cynic might argue, well, there was a big fat paycheck if they stayed on, stayed out there and carried on. I wouldn't suggest that, but some cynics might. So it's interesting what it takes to make someone jump on a plane. But now they're coming home. Now they're trying to find a window to get it in. But as you are constantly reminding me, the cricket season never stops.
Ends.
There's never any gaps.
No.
So, you know, this one may be the IPL that never finished.
Very interesting. That's Matt Gatwood. And, of course, we will bring you the news of Chelsea playing Real Madrid tonight. I'm rooting for Chelsea, even if Matt Gatwood isn't.
Not at all.
The Arsenal fan, Matt Gatwood.
Unfair. I'm very unfair.
Lovely to talk to you.
Thank you.
Thank you. If you want to get in touch, you can tweet us at Mail Plus or me at Tory Boy Pierce. So should we all be trying out Kakabo? Yeah, you heard me. I'm going to say it again. Kakabo. It's the Japanese art of mindful spending. This week, Money Mail, that great investigative source, looked at savings habits from around the world, from Susu savings in Africa and the Caribbean to Lagom, the Swedish ideal of living in moderation, which holds very little appeal for me, has to be said. I'm joined now by Chief Money Mail reporter, Amelia Murray. Now, Amelia, come on then. Kakabo, what is it, the Japanese art of mindful spending, and do you recommend it?
So this is really interesting. I really enjoyed writing the story and looking into it because, it's great to take inspiration from around the world. So Kakabo was invented more than 100 years ago by the first female journalist in Japan. And what I found interesting is basically in Japan, the women are in charge of the family finances and they're busy and they've got, it's a big responsibility. So what this woman did is she invented this, it's like a ledger. So it's a budget book to keep track of your spending. And basically the idea is it makes you more mindful. So you categorize your spend into, essentials and non-essentials and a couple of extra things. And at the end of each month, you reflect on where you're spending and whether it's necessary to do so. And the idea is moving forward, you're more mindful and you can you can stop spending where it is unnecessary. And this idea of mindful spending is becoming more popular, not necessarily this Japanese technique, but the idea of, keeping a budget or, at least keeping notes of what you're spending. You can see it reflected in technology. There are a number of budgeting apps. We've got, digital banks that allow you to categorize your own money into spending and saving pots. If you want to save for a holiday or if you want to save for a deposit for a house. So it's this idea of once it's put in front of you, you become a much more aware of what you are spending and whether it is truly necessary.
And does it work? Is it proven to work, Amelia?
I couldn't find any statistics. I mean, I think common sense would suggest, the awareness. I mean, if you're sensible.
Yeah, and if it's been around, I mean, she invented this in 1904, according to your copy.
Yeah.
So if it's still around over 100 years later, then I guess it must work for people.
Yeah. And what's cool is it's being picked up around the world. Like I was watching, a news video from America, like in 2017, where they were discussing it. People have written books on this practice as well. And I just, I think anything that's going to encourage more awareness about your income and outgoings has got to be a good thing.
Yeah. Now, what am I pronouncing this correctly? Susu savings or is it Sao Sao savings?
I think it's Susu.
I think so. Right. Let's stick to that. Now, this is popular in Africa and the Caribbean. And how does this one work?
These are great. I mean, they're all based on trust. So you've got to get a good group of people around you. It's usually made up of family members and friends. Everyone contributes a certain sum each week or each month, whatever you can afford. And at a certain time period, everyone takes the pot. So for example, if you 10 of you decided to put £100 in each month, every month one of you would take £1,000 and, it rotates. So by the end of the 10 months, everyone would have put in £1,000 and everyone would have taken out £1,000. So you end up clear. And what's, this is really interesting in certain communities where, people are saving up for education or for weddings or for, it's usually kind of event based or maybe for a new car. And I think it's a really, it says a lot about the community where they are putting their trust in one another. There's no regulation, as I said.
And do they put the money in an account or do they put it under the carpet, under the mattress, I mean?
I think it's under the mattress, isn't it, usually?
I think it is under the mattress, yeah.
I think it depends on the community. Usually there's a treasurer who's elected to look after the money. So I guess it kind of depends on what the decision, the, you know, what the group decides on. There's another similar thing which I came across in India and Pakistan, which are called kitty parties. And again, it's sort of this rotating savings club. However, with kitty parties, the social element is very important. So once a month, or you know, usually once a month, the women, because it's a female focused event, the women meet up, and it's a social gathering, and there might be games, and there might be food, and there's a host, and they, you know, again, they all put money in the pot, and one person takes it away. And what's interesting with these ones is how they've evolved. So over lockdown, they were still going on, but they were kind of forced to do it over Zoom. And before lockdown, some of these wealthier groups of women would take a little jaunt, perhaps to Europe, or you know, they might have a luncheon, or they might, I don't know, go to Vegas or something. So, you know, the contribution of the funds is part of it, but it's very much about gatherings of women, which I think is, yeah, just great. Yeah. I mean, that's one I'd go for, I think, out of all of these.
I was going to say, are you going to do something like that here? Are you smitten by these ideas now?
Yeah, I mean, I'm waiting to be invited to my first kitty party. So yeah. If anyone's interested in organising one, I would love to attend. I think, I mean, that sounds like the funnest one to me. Of course,
yeah,
like,
it does.
Like, read the article, you know, feng shui and kind of some of the practices in China are really interesting because lots of them are based in religion or tradition or ritual, which is just like fascinating because they've been going on for years. People, you know, the gods of wealth, the idea of feng shui, which is, you know, harmonious design of your home. You know, it's almost like they're surrounded by it, which, you know, it's not just an event like a kitty party. This is like a way of life or a lifestyle, which I think is amazing.
And if you get an invitation, can I come too? Or is it only going to be women?
It has, well, traditionally, it's popular among, you know, housewives.
Well,
but, you know, hey, it's 2021. I'm sure we can do a modern version. But I would insist on very strict rules, which is what I've read about. So once you commit, you have to go every month. Otherwise, you might be hit with a penalty. So it depends on how reliable you will be in your attendance, Andrew.
I think I might just rely on a first-person report from you, if that's all right.
Okay.
How does that sound? Very good. That is our fabulous Chief Money Mail reporter, Amelia Murray. It's a fabulous piece. Kakibo, Susu, Sao Sao, it's all there. And I think there's no doubt Amelia Murray, she would be elected the treasurer in that Susu group, wouldn't she? I'd elect her.
I'd insist on it.
Exactly. That's all we've got time for today. For the latest from the Daily Mail, you can download the Mail Plus app. Every weekday at 5 p.m, you can listen to me all over again. I'm Andrew Pearce. This is The Andrew Pearce Show. I'll be back tomorrow. Have yourselves a great evening and good night.